The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Here last week, since it was the first Monday after the election, but this is the first Monday that I've been here, so one of the consequences of this election for me in coming here to IMC is to want to welcome everyone here, and that everyone is welcome to be here, and as a place of faith, I suppose, I think of this place as a refuge or a sanctuary for anybody who finds it interesting or valuable to be here. And I've talked to many people in the last now almost 2 weeks who and read about many people in this country who feel quite afraid in a way that I have not, you know, never seen it done so explicitly for a long time. And so people who come here to IMC or to IRC or to Buddhist groups or many places in the world feel that there's danger for them as they walk through the city, as they walk about, because they belong to certain populations of people who have been targeted. It's quite phenomenal to me to read how much of that's going on here in California. First I kind of thought, well, all that, the expressions of hatred and that have now been documented around the country, I kind of thought it was somewhere else, was my thought. And the first thing I heard was from Lori Wong, who's a Dharma teacher in Modesto, and she has a student who's a Hispanic origin, an American citizen, and his son went to school on Wednesday after the election and was told in the schoolyard that he didn't belong here. So that was, you know, well, California's still Modesto, it's far away. And the next thing I heard was that a child was beat up in my son's high school on Wednesday after the election because of the election, having to do with tensions in the school around it. And that's right here in Redwood City. And then, well, certainly not some liberal bastion like Berkeley. And then there's was a woman who wore hijab, who was walking through the parking lot in Berkeley and had the hijab torn off her head in UC Berkeley. And then we have the Confederate flag being kind of brought out on a parade in Napa Valley on Veterans Day, just a few days after the election. And so, you know, so many people are frightened. And so it's very important, I feel, to kind of reinforce the idea that everyone who wants to is welcome here. And welcome not just because they're welcome to come, but welcome with the intention of making this a safe place for everyone. And so that, I think we're committed, I'm committed to making this safe for the people who come. And to welcome everyone, no matter what, who you are, really. One of the things the Buddha instructions or kind of teachings from the Buddha, it's a beautiful, I think for me, a very beautiful sentence where he said, make yourself a refuge for all beings. And the idea that you would make yourself a refuge, you'd make yourself someone who is safe for all beings, and not only are you safe, but a place you can come to for safety. And one of the great gifts that Buddhism says you can give to others is the gift of fearlessness. And because if you, meaning two things, but you, one thing means that they have nothing, no reason to fear you. And I think this is a phenomenal gift to give anyone, the lack of fear. Because there are people in our society who have never experienced the absence of fear. I remember many years ago a woman who came to Spirit Rock for a retreat, and she was walking around the hills a little bit around Spirit Rock. It's in the, you know, the oak woodlands of Marin County. And she came and reported that the walking around Spirit Rock was the first time she had ever felt safe walking around in nature or somewhere walking around anywhere in her life. That's quite something for someone to say. So to be a refuge, to give a gift of fearlessness. And my hope is that a center like ours, people who practice here, people who kind of get trained in Buddhism, understand the gift of fearlessness and become someone that no one needs to fear. And in a climate right now where there's lots and lots of fear going on, what's very difficult, I think, is the amount of people who are also willing to deny that there's any problem and say, well, it's not really happening, or there's nothing really to fear, or it's a misunderstanding, or diminishing the ways in which some people feel afraid. I think that it's, you know, it's very real. And what's sad is that some of the people who feel targeted and feel like there's problem, you know, danger for them, are people who have been feeling this for decades. And things have improved, but as somehow things have improved, there's often a if they speak up or point out that there's still tensions in the society, it kind of gets brushed over, you know, not noticed, kind of denied, or people don't want to really, you know, see it or something, and can't really be as bad as it is. And but now it's kind of come out so prominently in our society. And the FBI, the variety of organizations that track hate crimes in this country have reported a sharp spike in hate crimes since the November election. And, you know, all over, including right here in our liberal, you know, West Coast. And, you know, is it just a coincidence? I mean, apparently hate crimes have been in the upswing over the last couple of years anyway. But there's some kind of cultural climate, some kind of cultural tensions that have been existed for a long time, which have come to the surface, fault lines in our society. And so we're meeting these fault lines. And how do we meet them? What do we do with them? So what might be interesting for you, I hope for you to hear about me, is that I began my Buddhist practice some 40 years ago. And then at some point, it was very important for me what I was doing, my Buddhism. I'll say it this way, and I started it because of my interest in, you know, it was back in the Vietnam War times. And the idea, one of the possibilities was I was going to get drafted. It was still the draft time. And so I was not going to go fight any war. I'm a very committed pacifist that way. And but a pacifist doesn't mean that I'm going to be passive. And I felt that if I was going to really stand behind my values, I'd have to at some point be ready to put my life online in acts of civil disobedience. And I was afraid of doing that. I was afraid of dying. And one of the strong attractions to Buddhism was somehow I got the idea and picked up the idea that Buddhism was a training to help us overcome our fear of death. And that I felt like that I wanted to do because I wanted to be able to live my ideals. So that was kind of interesting. I mean, I would say, you know, not I would say in a kind of interesting way, that all of you wouldn't be here today if that hadn't been my interest. So whatever you think about that I had that interest as a 20-year-old, still the fact that kind of got me going in this direction, and this whole place wouldn't be here, that, you know, you wouldn't be here in this way. And so then I practiced for many years, and then in about 1981, I was living at the Tassajara Monastery in place in beautiful kind of wilderness and kind of just east of Big Sur Coast and the Big Sur Mountains. And deep in the mountains there, and we would spend months at a time without really anybody coming in from the outside during the winter time. Very quiet and very peaceful place, doing lots of intensive practice. And then one day, during those the retreat times they had there, the practice periods, periodically we'd get news coming in. We'd get a newspaper or news magazine coming in, and it was always very interesting to read the news late. And there's a little footnote or kind of little advice to all of you who might need it. It's really wise to read the news late. Read old news, even if it's a one day old, because there's something about the urgency of the latest news which somehow gets underneath your, you know, kind of gets you emotionally connected or involved or alarmed or concerned. And we're not really, I think, and also there's wonderful journalists who write in these brilliant ways, these really good journalists that kind of carry you into it and get alarmed or excited or something. But if you read it, when you know you're reading it one or two or three or days late, it's like, oh, you know, you can still learn all the facts you need to know, but it doesn't quite have the same emotional kind of feeling. If you really want to do a good job doing that way, to really kind of free yourself from the emotional, excessive emotional connection to the news, but still be well-informed, be a witness of it all, an interesting place to read the news is Wikipedia. Try it next time, that when you find something really important in the news that you want to read, what's going on, and if you go to Wikipedia, just type in Wikipedia, like, you know, Trevor Martin, I did that one, you know, when he was killed. And you get all this different, it's like an encyclopedia entry, right? It's very matter of fact, there's no emotionality to it, it's very kind of clinical almost. And so you get kind of a survey, an overview of the situation that you sometimes can't get from the newspapers. Newspapers, you know, sometimes the newspapers are, or the news is just so new, it's like the latest, greatest piece of the whatever's happening, as if they assume you know the background. And so the Wikipedia gives you background and everything. And I don't know if it's any less biased in terms of the facts than anywhere else, but, you know, at least it's, I kind of like sometimes the overview it provides. So anyway, those of you who find it difficult to be with the news but want to be informed, there are other options besides checking the news every hour. So here I was at the monastery. And so we got to get the news usually late. And so one day I found, I think it was like on a rock someplace, I think it was either a Newsweek or a Time magazine. And so I opened it up, just opened it. And there were large, you know, just a couple of spreads, page spread, photographs of a refugee camp that had just been aerial bombed during a war. And it happened in a city that I had been to when I was 11. And it was, you know, not so far from where I lived. And so, you know, maybe that kind of connected me more to these pictures and the story. And it really had a big impact on me, you know, after these months of silence and practice. And my heart was maybe very open. I was very sensitive. And it kind of just went right in. And wow. And that's when I decided that I was going to devote my life to being bringing Buddhism to people, Buddhist practice to people, because I felt that Buddhism, what I'd encountered in my life up to that point, was one of the best ways that I knew for people to get to to touch or reach down into the roots of hate, of war, of conflict, of fear, of greed and hate, of attachment to self preoccupation. And that it's really important for some people, for us to really get down to the very root of it, because we don't want to just have a bandage on top of the suffering of the world. We want to really get, and we don't want to kind of somehow constantly be negotiating the tensions and getting all the tensions just right, you know, and balanced. I mean, someone should show that we can purify the heart. Someone should get to the bottom of it all. And I thought Buddhism is a great way to do that. So that's when I set the road, not just to practice Buddhism, but to offer Buddhism as to the world. And that also brought me here as a Buddhist teacher. So I say all that in the background of my teaching here and my concern with supporting a community like this is the idea of war, this idea of social conflicts of large scale. And I think that my understanding, my reading of Buddhism, the way I've been taught by studying Buddhism, I don't know what effect it's going to have on you for me to say this. I hope it's not the wrong way. I kind of expect the worst. I expect war to happen. I expect terrible things to happen. I'm kind of amazed there hasn't been war. I grew up in the shadow of World War II. The adults that I knew growing up would tell stories of their experience of World War II, and it was very fresh and alive, and, you know, it was pretty horrendous. I grew up in Europe, so growing up there. My mother was... She didn't see much of the war in Norway, but she had the experience one day of getting out of bed, and as she stood next to her bed, out of the bed, just that time, a German ammunition ship exploded in the harbor, and chaparral from the ship flew through the window right into her pillow where she'd been laying. You know, it's maybe a small story, but, you know, or my parents-in-law were Holocaust survivors and went through the camps. They lost their parents in the camps, German concentration camps. So that's kind of the world I grew up in. And I think that, and Buddhism, you know, Buddhism doesn't have a lot of, you know, Buddhism focuses on trying to create a better world, absolutely. But it doesn't have a high expectation for social nirvana. So the idea that, and I think that we've had an amazing stretch of peace in, you know, for many people in the Western world for the last 70 years. It's kind of, to me, it's pretty impressive given the history of places like Europe and stuff. Anyway, so the challenges we have now, I don't find it surprising that they come up. And I wonder whether it's actually in some ways healthy, because a lot of these forces have been underground for a long time, and boy, are they ever in the foreground now, and, you know, for everyone to see, and in a way that we can't kind of dance, you know, pretend and dance around them anymore. So it's a, you know, it's a, for some people, it's a very tense time, and I think that there's a lot of soul searching, a lot of questioning, a lot of wondering about what we have and what are the values we want to live by and how to go forward from here. And so a few things. One is that the more, so I don't know, I don't know all of you and your the impact it's had on you. It could be, I imagine a room full of this many people, there's a whole range of possible responses to what's happened in the last couple of weeks. So I don't want to assume that I know you when I speak like this. But one of the things that the practice teaches us is how important it is to light the candle inside ourselves. There's a saying that it's better to light a candle than curse in the darkness. And so... the practice of Buddhism, the practice of mindfulness, meditation, compassion, is to light a candle, light a light inside of ourselves. And the Buddha said once, be a light unto yourself. And so the light of awakening, of clarity, of honesty, of ethics, of compassion, the light of our goodness, to turn it on and don't, you know, and protect it so that it can grow and develop. And one of that, part of that light is the light of attention. and knowing how to give attention to what needs attention within us and the world around us. And so for some of us here, there's a lot of fear. And so the practice of turning on the light is not to belittle the fear, not to explain it away, but to turn on the light to it and say, here, let's admit it. Let's be honest about it. Let's hold it here. Let's recognize it. It's very important. Some people are really angry, and so we turn on the light, so we on anger and let that live in us, not to fester, but in order to let it kind of be seen in a compassionate light, to see what it has to teach us, what can grow out of it, what good it can do for us, not how it can harm us in the world, but what does anger do? And some people are depressed, some people are sad. I was talking to someone today, one of the teachers for the at the retreat they had at Spirit Rock. It was a week-long retreat that spanned over the election. So after Wednesday, when the results of the election came in, everyone in the retreat knew about the results of the election. And so they felt they need to talk about it that morning, because the teacher said he's never seen so much, so many tears, at a Spirit Rock before. Often people cry, you know, someone's crying. 80 people at Spirit Rock, usually someone's crying. the person said, I've never seen so many people. You know, it's an environment where people are pretty sensitive and open. So the idea is to turn on the light, is to hold it, and you know, or have it be in a place where it's safe to have it, to recognize, to be able to talk about it and have it in the open and not be ashamed of or embarrassed or troubled by it, but just to open it up. But then also in Buddhism is to learn not to be limited by the fear, limited by the anger, limited by the sadness we might feel, the grief. And this is where I think that, whereas Buddhism, I don't think is not particularly famous for a positive utopian view of society and where it's all going to go and end up. I don't think that's the great, you know, big calling card of Buddhism. But Buddhism does have a very strong message about how thoroughly and completely we can transform ourselves. And as we transform ourselves, that we become someone then who can step into society and become a refuge for all beings. We become someone who can step forward to try to offer to change the world for the better. How much we can do is an open question. But that the point in Buddhism is not so much how much you can do, how much you can accomplish, but how much you can try to accomplish. To kind of step, because what else are you going to do? It's a wonderful thing to do. It's a wonderful way of living a life. And so to come back to act in the world from a place of confidence rather than a place of fear. And this is one of the things that I think that the Buddhist practice can lead to, is we kind of work through or work with our fear or anger or sadness or whatever, all these things. Work through it, sit with it, become wise about it, meet it with compassion, so that it doesn't limit us, but instead we find it, if anything, it becomes the compost or the fuel for us to be able to act. And act is what we need to do, somehow. And the more powerful you've been affected by these kinds of events, whether it was 9/11 or whether it was this election or many things, you know, that go on. If you're someone who's been affected by it in very strong ways, one of the ways to give justice to what you're experiencing to yourself is to allow yourself to be changed by the event. If you are alarmed, angry, frightened, distressed by something that's really big in society, in our world, and, you know, it really has shaken you up, we have tremendous ability, many of us, to go back to the usual, to go back to normal, to kind of, well, you know, after a few weeks, it's kind of like passes and we kind of forget it, and it kind of, we hope for the better, or kind of we drift away from it, and we go back sometimes to life as usual. And I think then we do a tremendous disservice to our hearts. If our hearts have been really affected so strongly by something, I think that to allow ourselves to be changed by it is how we, you know, heal from it or reconcile with it, or, you know, then it's done some good in the world. But if we're only upset and alarmed and we keep expecting someone else to be changed by it, someone else to do something, I think something inside of us, some candle, some light inside of us diminishes rather than grows. So I had that feeling after 9/11. And so one of the changes that I did was, I feel like I can't go back to normal, to usual. I can't, you know, have to do something. And so I started a training program for people to become Buddhist chaplains. And it was a kind of non-political act of trying to bring forces of good in our society, in our world. So every year now, for the last, I don't know, 13, 14 years, we have a year-long training program here, in this room here, where we train people in skills and knowledge and practices that have to do with being a chaplain. We offer spiritual care in places like hospitals, prisons, hospices, the homeless, you know, many interesting places. People usually in big moments of crisis in their lives. It's been one of the great sources of surprising joy for me to do this. I call it a pyramid scheme for joy. Because, you know, we train these people here, and then they go out, and it's amazing what they do in hospitals and prisons and, you know, hospices and all these places, and the lives they touch, and then they come back with stories to us and tell us what they're doing, and it's really inspiring. And so, you know, I've given a lot of time and effort to that, and so I offer you that as an example of someone who, that I have to be changed by this. I'm not going to sit here and wait for someone else to be changed, to change something. I have to be changed. So for those of you who have been affected greatly by this election, if you haven't been affected by the election in some deep way, then maybe you don't have to be changed. But if you have been, I think you do kind of a violence to yourself, maybe, if you just continue to be upset and keep directing it outwards without acting yourself, doing something for yourself, changing yourself. And one of the things that makes fear stronger, that makes fear bigger in people's lives, is when they feel like they have no ability to respond, to act. There's nothing they can do. But if people feel they can do something, fear tends not to have as strong a power over us. And feeling we can do something doesn't have to be end the Iraq war. It doesn't have to be, you know, some big thing in the world. But we can do something. We have a candle. Light your candle and then shine it on some little corner of the world where it makes sense for you to shine it on. I felt very fortunate that I was able, in a position to create a Buddhist chaplaincy training program. Things were in place that I was able to kind of not, you know, in 2002, I guess, to start it up. I felt very fortunate. 10 years before, I couldn't have done it. So each of us are in some circumstance where we can do something. And it might be that, it could be that you just decide to help your neighbors more. Or you decide to, maybe you have work that you do, but you decide to do your work, whatever your profession is, but do it with twice as much dedication to kindness and compassion for the people that you encounter in your work. Twice as much dedication to doing your work with integrity and honesty. I remember many years ago when I was first being trained as a Buddhist teacher, I went along to a retreat to sit in on interviews. So we kind of watch students and teachers have discussed something. This guy came and said, in my profession, I'm expected to lie. And how could I be a good Buddhist and lie at the same time? So that's an interesting dilemma. So the teacher said, you can't. So, you know, maybe in your small world, you know, what can you do? Maybe you can do a big thing. Maybe you can, you know, or maybe you can be someone who helps create a safer world. If you see someone with a hijab walking down the street, maybe you want to, you know, keep a little eye on the person to see if you can protect her if someone tries to harass her, and not just kind of, you know, make her feel safe in our society. So to be changed, to allow ourselves to be changed, or to act and do something, it's quite impressive all the donations that ACLU has gotten. Since the election, they've received $11 million and 150,000 new members. And they weren't even fundraising. So into many organizations now, you know. So that, you know, people feel if you can do something, it takes the sting out of the fear. It gives us some sense of power, some sense of agency. The lack of agency is debilitating. And the thing about not doing something to lessen our fear, lessen the grip that fear can have, is that fear is a source, can be a source, unprocessed fear, unattended fear, is a source for a lot of dysfunctional activity in the world. The Buddha said fear is a source of violence in our society. And so how to hold strong and difficult emotions in a supportive way, how to recognize it, and how to respond to it, I think is one of the big tasks. And then I think what makes this particular, for people who are alarmed by what's happening with administration, the new incoming administration, is that so many of things that the president-elect has claimed he's going to do are horrifying for big segments of the population. And so if he keeps his word, it's going to be pretty bad. But this is a man who's known for saying things off the cuff that he doesn't mean, apparently. So a lot of people are kind of like waiting, what's going to happen? And feel like we have to wait and wait and find out. But we shouldn't just wait. And whether you're a Trump supporter or not a Trump supporter, the message of Buddhism is never wait in terms of preparing yourself for what you might be asked to do. And that's what Buddhist practice is partly to do, is to prepare ourselves, to make us into someone who knows ourselves well. We've worked through some of the deeper attachments and fears and angers and unresolved issues that we carry with us. We've worked through some of the attachments that limit and inhibit us from acting in the world with courage. We've worked through our fear of dying. We've worked through the ways in which we limit our capacity for compassion and love and integrity. We've understood something really deep and valuable about integrity, what it's like to act from a place of being awake, what it's like to act with efficacy in the world, but to do so out of a place of freedom, rather than out of a place of being caught and attached, so that we're prepared for when something difficult happens, we can step forward and meet that in the way that is best suited at that time. So we don't know what we're going to be asked to do in this world of ours. But I think it's one of the great things is to be prepared, to do the work. And so if we have too much of a utopian dream, that we think that everything's going to be rosy, so we can lower our guard and not prepare ourselves, I think that we do the world a disservice. I think we want to make ourselves utopian individuals, not a utopian society that takes care of us. We want to make ourselves wonderful people so we can take care of society and not wait for someone else to take care of us. And so Buddhism, we were preparing ourselves. And the practices of mindfulness, of meditation, all these things are wonderful preparations for what might, whether it's social or environmental, the San Andreas Fault has a burp, or whether it's personal, familial, in your family. The idea that sooner or later, a few of you are going to have to face some of these rare events like sickness, old age, and death. A few of you. But we don't know which ones of you. So we prepare ourselves for the inevitable that might come. So, sooner or later, something will come. And then it's good to be prepared. And I've known people who were angry. Oh, there was a wonderful man who came to IMC for a while. Older man. And he came to me one day and said, "Well, you know, my kids, my adult kids, are starting to worry about me. And they think that, maybe you should go see a psychiatrist. Something's wrong with you. Maybe you're having some kind of brain damage or something." And they were really worried about him. He said, "The reason they were worried was that my whole life I was anxious. And now after practicing this practice, I'm no longer anxious." So they can't believe it. They think something's wrong with me. So the forces of greed, hate, and delusion have been around for millennia. They didn't start with the election. And the technology for overcoming greed, hate, and delusion has been around for millennia. And we didn't suddenly discover them with the election. It's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's a profound thing to be dedicating one's life, to whatever degree we do, to purifying the forces of greed, hate, and delusion inside of us, to find a way to set our hearts free, to light the candle so it shines brightly for the world. It's one of the great tasks of a lifetime. It's one of the greatest purposes of a life that Buddhism at least teaches, is to do this inner work that makes us someone who can be a refuge for all beings, that helps turns us into someone who becomes a force for the better, for good in our society. It's a worthwhile thing to create a world of peace and well-being. So I hope these words are helpful or touch you in some way, that those of you who feel struggling with this. I don't know how to do this kind of talk. At least before I gave it, I didn't know how to do it. But now I did it, but I don't know what impact it had. It's not easy for me to know how to respond to this kind of thing. But I do want to encourage you to always believe in yourself and always believe that you can make a difference. And that in any small way that you can make a difference, it helps you and it helps those people around you. And don't limit your efforts to make a difference because you feel like you can't do enough. Anything that you do is better than doing nothing. So I hope that those of you who come to IMC and do this practice here, that you'll find ways that this practice supports you to become someone who makes this world a better place. And I've staked my life on the belief that that's the case, that we're trying to make a better world this way. So I apologize for talking so much, and we don't have time now for to hear from you. But some of you would like to feel a strong need to talk. You're welcome to come up here in the front, and I'm happy to meet with you a little bit. And I'll end with a quote from the Buddha. So the Buddha gave these instructions when the first 60 people who had studied with him long enough to become spiritually mature and were ready for this instruction. And he said, "Go forth for the welfare of gods and humans. Go forth for the welfare of others." So that's my hope for you as you leave now. Go forth. Thank you.